dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. March 20th marks the one-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, and people all over the world are planning to protest the ongoing occupation of that country. In the first hour of the program, a recent speech by Tariq Ali about the occupation, the resistance, and the importance of the American peace movement. In our second hour, we begin the final section of Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt. This section on resisting indoctrination.
Soon, like lightning, we soon will be riding my shiny black bears. No fat rich man's pony can overtake you.
Tariq Ali was born in Lahore, Pakistan, and educated in Britain, where he has lived since the 1960s. He's a prolific writer of books and articles, as well as films, plays, and novels. He's also a member of the editorial board of the New Left Review. His latest books, Bush in Babylon and The Clash of Fundamentalisms, both published last year, deal with the Middle East and its battles with Western empires. He spoke at Binghamton University on February 19, 2004.
Happy to be here. This is a campus where many of my friends have been over the last 30 years and taught and studied and gone, and this is the first time I managed to come here. So I'm very grateful to the organizations who set this up. Now, before 6 months before the war on Iraq began, a whole group of people, different parts of the world, warned of the following things in debating those who were ready to go to war, both in this country and in Britain. The first thing we said was that there weren't weapons of mass destruction. There was absolutely no evidence for this. The second thing we said was that Saddam Hussein had no links with Al-Qaeda. He may have had many other defects, but he had no links with Al-Qaeda. He had no weapons of mass destruction. At that time, these views were constantly attacked in the mainstream media. The Economist, editorial after editorial, saying these weapons are dangerous and they threaten the Western world. The New York Times didn't believe he had links with Al-Qaeda, but was absolutely convinced he had weapons of mass destruction. Likewise, the Washington Post. Likewise, the LA Times. Likewise, the Murdoch Empire. Likewise, virtually every mainstream newspaper in this country and quite a few in Britain. Now, that in itself poses a massive problem for the functioning of democracy. When the media becomes such an essential pillar in the waging of war that propaganda is presented as news and there is no independent investigative journalism in a large bulk of the mainstream press. And what is the situation today? Today, it's public knowledge that there aren't weapons of mass destruction. And if there are a few Al-Qaeda activists there, they weren't there during the time of Saddam, but they've been encouraged there by the occupation that is taking place. That's another small irony. So why did the politicians lie to go to war? Because their lies have cost the people of Iraq dear. Often in the Western world and in the Northern Hemisphere, the lives of those who live in the South don't count for much. And the fact that there are between 11 to 12,000 Iraqi civilians and soldiers have died in this war means nothing. The figures we get are 600 US soldiers who've died, 3,000 seriously wounded US soldiers, probably double that number who've been wounded, between 2,000 and 3,000 who've been withdrawn because they've had mental breakdowns, nervous breakdowns in Iraq, because they were not prepared for the hostility of the population. These are bad figures. But all I say is, don't separate them from the Iraqis who have died already and are dying every single day. Now, when they went to war, it's obvious, if you study what they said, that they were not prepared for a resistance. They thought they would take Iraq, which we all knew they would because of such superior military power and technological power. No one doubted that the United States would capture Iraq. But what we warned them about, in public, in the press in Britain, that there would be a resistance, that this wasn't some tiny little Balkan province. This was a sovereign, independent Arab state with a history of resisting occupations, with four insurrections against the British Empire from the 20s to the 50s, four big insurrections and many minor ones. And that regardless of what people thought or didn't think of Saddam Hussein or whether he was popular or hated, regardless of that fact, the occupation would not be welcomed by the people of Iraq. And yet, the great thinker president thought that they would be welcomed with sweets and flowers. Now, why did they think this? They thought this because they were told this by a group of tame Arabs who work for them, the House Arabs of the American Empire. Fuad Ajmi, Kenan Makia, this whole gang told them, please go, the people of Iraq are waiting, they've been waiting for a long time, and you will be greeted with sweets and flowers, the exact phrase used by these people in the White House. Now, one reason they said that is they may have believed it. Another reason they said that is because that is what the principals of the war wanted to hear. That's what Cheney, Rumsfeld, Pearl, Wolfowitz wanted to hear, that this is how they would be welcomed, that they were going to liberate an Arab country. Well, that didn't happen. And that began to, and that shocked them. It stunned both the soldiers in the field who had been briefed, and it stunned the politicians. And quite interestingly, you had a very rapid development of an armed resistance in Iraq, which began to score hits and casualties virtually the second week after the occupation. And even those who didn't join the armed resistance made it clear, as the British deputy consul in Iraq said to BBC television, I have absolutely no doubt that the bulk of the people of Iraq loathe this occupation. Well, thank you. A bit late now. When we tried to tell you this before you went in, you didn't listen. And you accused people who opposed the war of being apologists of Saddam Hussein. So what do we have now when it's become clear that the reasons given to the populations and the citizens of Britain and the United States to go to war were falsehoods, manufactured falsehoods? When the intelligence agencies couldn't come up with the right answers, they were put under heavy pressure by the politicians, by Downing Street in London, by the White House staff here. We want information which helps us to go to war. That's what they said. But okay, so you've taken Iraq and you still can't find the weapons. And finally, on Meet the Press, not so long ago, the great thinker president was asked, well, where are the weapons of mass destruction? Why did you go to war? And he said, oh, well, you know, the weapons are neither here nor there. Basically, he said, Saddam Hussein is a madman. That's what he said. Now, for the President of the United States to explain to a large television audience that the reason he went to war in Iraq is because Iraq is run by a madman sets a very dangerous precedent. Think about it. I mean, who's to prevent any state from deciding that another state is run by a madman? And by mad, you mean people who act irrationally, lie, are paranoid. So it's not a clever thing to say. But one could have asked, and the journalist should have asked him, could you explain to us, Mr. President, when exactly Saddam Hussein's mental health deteriorated? Which year was it? Which month? If you want to say he was a madman when he used chemical weapons against the Kurdish population of Halabja, that was when he was a close ally of the West. You didn't stop him. You even vetoed a resolution condemning the attack on the Kurdish village in the Security Council. And Tony Blair refused to vote against it when a motion was presented in the House of Commons. Or was he a madman when he went to war against Iran? How could he be? He was armed, given enormous amounts of support, weaponry, by every single Western country. So that couldn't be when he was a madman. He became a madman when he decided, for reasons of his own, to break with the West, which wasn't of his own making, but that's another story. So to explain world politics in terms of madness and good and evil doesn't help anyone, because it doesn't help a population to understand what's going on in that part of the world. So basically, we now know from Paul O'Neill's memoirs, as written by Ron Susskind in a best-selling book, that they had decided that they wanted to go after Iraq in week two of the Bush administration, well before 9/11. They were determined to take Iraq, and O'Neill describes how a number of people at that crucial meeting were discussing oil, were discussing strategic priorities, were saying this is a government which didn't do the United States bidding, and it would be good to stabilize the Middle East if we had every government doing our bidding. That's when they decided to go to war. After 9/11, it became impossible to resist because of those events, and they manufactured evidence, and they went to war. Now, what amazes me always is how detached citizens in the West have become from history not to have understood that there would be a resistance in Iraq. No one in the Arab world doubted it for a moment. And when 4 months into the occupation, Paul Wolfowitz, one of the masterminds of the war, arrived in Baghdad and gave a press conference, and he was asked, well, how do you explain the security situation? How come that the security situation is so bad? And Wolfowitz said, you know, there is a big problem in Iraq. I accept that. Do you know what it is? And the journalist said, what is it? He said, there are too many foreigners coming into Iraq. He wasn't referring to the US Army. He wasn't referring to 2/3 of the British Army, which is back in the old bases they used to occupy in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. He wasn't referring to the Poles, the Bulgarians, the Ukrainians, the Japanese. He was referring to other Arabs coming in from neighboring Arab countries to help fight the resistance. That's how twisted people can become and not understand why there is a resistance taking place in Iraq. And how does this link to the war on terror? The so-called war on terror was initially designed to crush Al-Qaeda, an organization at most of 2,000 to 3,000 operatives in different parts of the world. And they said that they would go to war against Afghanistan to defeat Al-Qaeda, destroy it completely, and bring back Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Remember the words? Bring him dead or alive. And they said that they'd pinpointed where he was, and they announced this. And then when 2 weeks later, troops arrived at the caves at the foothills of the Pamir Mountains in Afghanistan, they were surprised to find that there was no one there. You announce in public you're going to kill him. You say you're going to bomb the caves into oblivion. And then you arrive and he's not there and you're surprised. The other guy they said they were going to find in Afghanistan was Mullah Omar, the leader of the pro-Osama faction inside the Taliban. That was the other big person they were after. Now, with the biggest surveillance techniques the world has ever known, where from a satellite you can see what's going on in a country almost. And they said they had him targeted, which isn't difficult because this is a guy who's got a very bad leg. He limps and he's got one eye, war-wounded guy. So it's not difficult to pinpoint him. But they couldn't find him either. And they reported that when last seen, he was on a motorbike heading towards the desert. Unlike Steve McQueen in The Great Escape, Mullah Omar got away. He actually got away. No one knows where he is. Osama still hasn't been found. Al-Qaeda left its base in Afghanistan and moved elsewhere. And the regime imposed on Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, one of the old worker agents for the agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, made Prime Minister of Afghanistan, who is so aware of the hostility to him that he doesn't trust a single Afghan to form part of his bodyguard. You have US Marines guarding him nonstop, which doesn't augur well for either his own future or the future of the country on which he's been imposed. And I've always felt it would be far better to pull him out as soon as possible. He has these lovely shawls and he could parade as a model in Paris or New York. Don't keep him there because his life is unfortunately limited. Sooner or later, someone will get him. Because people don't like being occupied. However awful their governments are, they prefer consciously and subconsciously to deal with these governments themselves. So the big problem which confronted the United States after 9/11, what to do, they blew it, basically. They blew it. Is the world safer from small groups of terrorists because of what's happened subsequently? I don't think so. I don't think so. The only way in which the world could be made safer is if you understood, if the US administration understood, that the key task is to stop the flow of recruits to groups like that. And you can only do that by understanding what the political problems are and trying to reach political solutions. You cannot do it by waging wars. And the two key questions in the Arab East were the continuing sore of Palestine, the sanctions regime against Iraq, which had wrecked that country and weakened its population and made the population more dependent on the state than it had ever been before. And the weekly bombing raids, Anglo-American bombing raids on Iraq, which went on for 12 years, that by the end of those raids, Pentagon officials were telling the New York Times, we've run out of targets in Iraq, we don't know what to bomb. And this was a country which supposedly posed a threat. Just doesn't make sense. And as the whole world knows now, if Saddam Hussein had had weapons of mass destruction, they would never have invaded. Like North Korea, a much weaker country than Iraq, but he does possess them, and said he would use them if his country was invaded. And immediately diplomacy came into play. So they knew he didn't have them. That's why they went in. That is precisely why they went in. They knew it was a weak country with a weak army which could be taken quickly. But the situation in that part of the world has now become worse. Because one of the things they did after 9/11 was to abandon all attempts at serious negotiations in the Middle East, either with Iraq or in the Palestine-Israeli conflict. Sharon became a valued ally in the war against terror. Putin in Russia became a valued ally in the war against terror. A guy who has virtually destroyed Chechnya, razed the Chechen capital Grozny to dust, killed between 20 and 30,000 Chechens. There were 1,800 deaths in Kosovo, remember? 1,800 after NATO began bombing, not before. And in Chechnya, between 20 and 30,000. And these double standards are noticed by people in most parts of the world. And what they realize is that great empires, powerful empires, and this applies to them all, historically have always acted in their own interests. They don't act in the interests of anyone else. And the national security, the national strategy doctrine of the Bush administration makes that very clear if you read it. We will defend what we consider our interests by any means necessary, including the use of force to preserve US hegemony. That's what they say, and that's what Iraq is about, a display of imperial power, which also helps get control of the oil, which is an added bonus. It wasn't just the oil. It was a display of imperial power to show that at the beginning of the 21st century, we could take a country and remold it according to our own needs and our own desires. And after we had done that, we would move towards dealing with Iran and Syria. Well, Iran and Syria are lucky, because that's not going to happen now. Because if there was an attempt to invade Syria and Iran, there would be a rebellion within the Pentagon. Because these are the guys who've got to carry out these instructions. And they know what the situation on the ground is. I don't know whether you're aware, but there have been three showings of a classic anti-colonial film, Pontecorvo's Battle of Algiers, in the Pentagon. Not normally a venue for seeing old art house movies. But they've been seeing it because the movie is very revealing. And it shows that even when the French succeeded in clamping through terror, crushing the rebellion in France, the battle would be won some years later by the Algerians. And that is going to be the case here too. So what then is the way out? I think the way out is to demand an end to the occupation, to give the Iraqi people now what they are demanding, which is their own, they will elect their own constituent assembly without a foreign presence, because that foreign presence is inhibiting, and this constituent assembly will frame a new constitution. and they will then vote. Now, people say when you say that, oh, yeah, but now if we withdraw, won't there be a mess? I say, excuse me, there is a mess. Just look at what's happening every single day in Iraq. Every single day. There's a big mess. There are acts of violence all over the country, including now in the south. So this is something which is not going to die down. And it's true, immediately after the withdrawal, different groups will jockey for power, but they are also quite capable, as they've done in the past when they defeated the British, of working closely together. And we will see what comes out of it. The one thing which is very clear is that the occupation isn't working, however much they try and conceal it. They captured Saddam Hussein. First, we were told the resistance was being masterminded by Saddam Hussein. When you saw photographs of this pathetic guy captured, I think most people understood that he couldn't have been masterminding anything. Then he was captured. Then they said, now the resistance will end because we've got the head guy. We argued at that time, far from the resistance ending, many who were reluctant to join the resistance because of Saddam Hussein would now join it. And that's exactly what's beginning to happen in different parts of Iraq. And nowhere, no other Arab country has agreed to send troops or to help them because they know it's suicidal. Marked difference to the first Gulf War. So this is an occupation which is becoming untenable by the day. And I think it's a real tragedy that whereas in other parts of the world, when you had the big mobilizations on February the 15th, they did have a big impact on their politicians. In Britain, when we had 1.5 million people out on the streets, the result was 80 Labour members of Parliament voted against the war. The tragedy is that in the United States, the Democrats were so aloof at that time from the mood amongst a section of the population, mainly their own supporters or potential supporters, that they didn't come out against the war. And so we now have an ironic situation in this country where the only Democrat who came out against the war is no longer in the running, and where all the other candidates voted for the war. So what price democracy? That's the tragedy. That dissent in the United States, opposition in the United States, which is no different from opposition elsewhere in the world, but the difference is that here it isn't reflected either in mainstream politics or in the mainstream media. That is not the case in Europe. Blair would like it to be the case, which is why he's trying to curb the BBC. Because he comes here, he sees what a slavish press Bush has, and he goes to Russia, sees how Putin controls the press, and then he often goes to Italy, where Berlusconi owns everything. And he says, what have I done to deserve the BBC? So he's trying to crush it. But it isn't working. There's a big backlash developing there too. But you see, as a result of the massive opposition in the British population to the war, we had two big broadsheet newspapers, The Guardian and The Independent, opposed to the war. We had a tabloid newspaper, The Daily Mirror, savagely opposed to the war. We had the BBC forced to reflect dissident opinions throughout the war. They cut it down, but they couldn't keep us off the air. That makes an enormous difference. Here, it was not like that. And I know there are wonderful indie media networks, etc., which are great. But they don't make up for the fact, and they can't because of the lack of money and power, of the control which the networks have in this country. So that's a big, big problem. A big problem. And it's ironic that since the collapse of communism, democracy itself has begun to go on the decline, almost as if it was the threat of communism which forced them to put on a brave show. Now they don't need to. You can do what you want. So the Washington Consensus, which rules the world or tries to rule the world, always had two legs. The neoliberal monster didn't just walk on one leg, the economic leg. It had another leg, the military leg, which it said it would use when it had to, and it did. It's used it in Iraq. But in terms of moving towards the world, a crucial area of the world, where there is peace, and there hasn't been peace for a long time, the Middle East, we now have two simultaneous occupations of Palestine and of Iraq. And what is going to be the future of Palestine? This is another subject which is rarely discussed in this country. In the mainstream, it's virtually absent. When you get reports of Palestinian suicide bombers, these are totally dissociated from the occupation. Totally. So people think these people are completely crazy. And it took a lot of struggle on the part of the Palestinians for many inside Israel to understand that something had to be done. And I'll just put it to you like this, that there is more opposition inside the mainstream media of Israel to what is being done to the Palestinians than there is in this country. There is more opposition amongst ordinary Israelis to what is being done to Palestine than in the diaspora in the United States. Otherwise, you can't explain what is published in Haaretz and Maariv. And what they write, those journalists. And you can't explain why one of the leaders of the Zionist movement in Israel, Avraham Burg, a former chairman of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, mainstream leader of the Israeli Labour Party, chairman of the Jewish Agency, wrote a public appeal to his fellow citizens. One of the more moving letters written in Israel by such a senior Zionist. And in this letter, he said, I think it was published here in the magazine Forward, not in the New York Times. In Europe, it was published in every mainstream newspaper. But the New York Times didn't publish it here. It was published in the left-wing Jewish magazine Forward in this country. And in this letter to his countrymen and his fellow leaders of Israel, Avraham Burg said, if we had been reduced to what the Palestinians have been reduced to by us, we would not have behaved differently. And he said, when you force a population to live like we force the Palestinians to live, when the border between life and death is very narrow and small, people live such awful lives that many of them don't fear death, then this is what they do. And understand that we are responsible for this. And that letter had a big impact in Israel. Of course he was attacked by lots of people, but he had the guts to say it. Which politician in the United States, Democrat or Republican, has the guts to stand up and say that? None of them do it. None of them do it. They're in total hock to Israel for reasons of their own. And they cannot differentiate between the state, the Israeli state, and its machinery, and many citizens of Israel who are fed up with this as well. How do we explain otherwise that between 700 and 800 reservists, Israeli reservists, have said they refuse to defend Israel outside the 67 frontiers? They will not fight. Many of them are being imprisoned. Very courageous people. Many of them are being tried. Or the Israeli Air Force pilots a few months ago who said, "We, when we decided to do what we are doing, we thought we had decided to join the Israeli Air Force. We didn't decide to join the mafia and go and carry out revenge killings." These are Israeli citizens, Jews, who are saying this, and one should learn from them. And it has an enormous impact on the whole Arab world. It's actions like this which make people understand that there is a difference between being a Zionist and being a non-Zionist Jew. It's not the same thing. Not all Jewish people are Zionists. Big difference, and always has been within the Jewish tradition. But it's gone completely, it's impossible to even discuss this seriously within the American media and within American politics. And it will end badly. Look, the attempts being made, which have been made, to wipe out the Palestinians as a political entity have failed. So you can build walls, you can build these obscene walls to further divide communities from each other. It won't work in the long run. It simply isn't going to work. It's ineffective, unless you decide to wipe out the whole Palestinian people physically. And that is unacceptable, mercifully, to large numbers of Israelis, though not to all of them, who wouldn't mind it. So this is a situation in which we have to speak up and actually follow the courageous example set by Israeli dissidents in their own society. And that isn't happening. So these are two, and what is the solution? There are only two possible solutions in Palestine, Israel. Either you have one state, with each citizen having the same rights, which the Zionist establishment won't accept, because technically it means in 10 years' time the Jews could be in a minority. It's a very foolish way of looking at it from my point of view, to say that a community is always monolithic. It isn't, as people will find out in Iraq with the Shia community fairly soon. It isn't monolithic. But they will not do it. Well, if you don't accept that, then you have to accept a Palestinian state and draw back to the 67 frontiers. You simply cannot have it both ways. It's one or the other. And simply creating a Palestinian protectorate won't work, like the Oslo Accords didn't work. Because if you have these shriveled little Bantustans divided by military roads, overlooked by Israeli tanks, infiltrated by Israeli settlers, obviously it's not going to work because it's a joke. This isn't independence. So on these two key issues, Palestine and Iraq, the United States government, the most powerful government in the world, has nothing to say, has nothing to offer except to defend the status quo. We went in and occupied Iraq and we were right, and Sharon is right and he has to be backed. That's basically what the Bush administration has done. And the situation is a dangerous one globally, because this is the first time in the history of humanity that we have a situation where there is one dominant empire and one empire alone. There is none other. That has never happened before, either in ancient times or in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, when you had lots of different empires. You had the American Empire, prior to 1917, a regional empire, expanding at home, gobbling up more territories and dominating Latin America. After 1917, a world empire, but till the late 40s and 50s, having to negotiate with the French Empire, the British Empire, two key empires. And then there came the Soviet Union and that whole world, and that has gone too. So there is now no countervailing force on a world scale, no state. Let's be blunt about this. There is no state which can act as a countervailing force. The Europeans can't do it because they are divided amongst themselves, and they would be divided. I mean, how can the European Union function properly when Tony Blair serves as the Trojan mule of the American Empire? How can they? Can't happen. The Far Eastern countries, which are the only other alternative, are too weak politically and militarily. I mean, China's military budget is $38 billion. The size of the US military budget is $438 billion. Japan still isn't allowed its own foreign policy. There are still US bases in Okinawa. The Korean Peninsula is still divided, not being brought together. And so this places an enormous responsibility on public opinion, on private citizens, on dissenting voices, especially in the United States of America. And that means you. It means that if nothing happens in the United States politically, if dissent is swallowed up or subsumed by traditional political parties, then it doesn't offer much help to the rest of the world. And that's why when on February the 15th it was announced at the big demonstrations of millions of people in Rome, in London, in Australia, the size of the demonstrations in New York, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, and in all the state capitals, there was enormous applause because people felt at one. And that is what reduces anti-American feelings in the rest of the world. Because when people say anti-Americanism is on the rise, it is, but it's not hostility to the population of the United States, but to the imperial ambitions and imperial actions of the United States. That's what creates the anger. And this is what US citizens had begun to understand at the end of the Vietnam War. Kerry's own testimony to the Congress, to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was very moving when he spoke on veterans against the war after he'd come back from Vietnam, saying exactly, pointing out what a big mistake had been made. And not just pointing out what a big mistake had been made, but pointing out, as he and many others did at that time, that how that war had debased the United States itself, that the war crimes carried out by American soldiers were horrific, chopping off the ears of Vietnamese people and putting them in a necklace round their neck. That was truly civilizational. And they did it systematically. The use of massive chemical weapons and defoliants. You have to remember all that. And one of the tragedies of this postmodern world, which developed after the collapse of communism, both on campuses and in society as a whole, was the total downgrading of history as a discipline, as a serious discipline. And history isn't just an academic discipline. The understanding of history is extremely crucial to understand what is going on in the world today. You can't understand even Al-Qaeda and their anger, which I don't support, you know, even to this degree. But you have to understand it if you want to combat them. And to understand it, you have to remember that these are people who fought shoulder to shoulder with the United States in the 80s in Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden was brought to Afghanistan by the United States. They needed a big Saudi name to go and inspire the backward tribes in Afghanistan to fight against the left regime backed by the Russians. All the bulk of the Al-Qaeda group was formed in that particular war. And all the secular forces in the Arab world were wiped out systematically during the Cold War period. And Saddam Hussein, another close ally of the United States and the West, even before he was used to fight wars. These are things you have to understand in order to grasp what is happening to the world today, and if we want to make the world better. And that requires an enormous lot from you as citizens of the United States, young and old. It's extremely important, because without a serious, consistent opposition in the United States, the rest of the world will suffer. And this opposition does have an impact. There's the great example of over 100 years ago, when the United States occupied the Philippines. Then, too, they said they were going to liberate it, but the Filipinos decided to resist. And the resistance was quite strong and heavy. And that resistance was crushed with many, many thousands of Filipino lives lost, and quite a few US soldiers died. But it so shocked the American intelligentsia of the time that the finest of them went public. Mark Twain, Henry James, William James, Du Bois, a whole group of them put a public call out to create an anti-imperialist league, which functioned very effectively for 5 to 6 years in virtually every American city. Now, these are different times. We can't simply mimic what they did. We have to find other ways of doing it. But if you do that, the one thing you can be assured of, that it's actions like that that bring enormous respect for the United States and not the wars. Thank you.
Following his speech, Tariq Ali took questions from the audience. Most of the questions were inaudible, so I'll paraphrase those. The first question was whether Bush would be elected in November.
Well, that depends on you. I have no vote. I mean, some of us who live in Britain feel that we should have a vote in the American election. Given that Britain follows whatever the United States does, so we should play a part in electing the US president. And we have quite an advanced voting system as well. Yeah.
Given the United States track record, what do you expect will happen?
Well, I think, the tragedy is that they went into this war without thinking. If one thinks about it seriously for a moment, there was opposition to this war not just from people on the liberal left. There was opposition from within the establishment. Some of the Pentagon generals were very unhappy because they said there are no clear war aims. Similarly in Britain, where senior figures inside the military and civilian intelligence services were very hostile to the war. And this is this in Europe is what created the big mood of opposition, that people were from top to bottom against the war. Now, if the present administration, Bush, Rove, Cheney, et al., stopped thinking for a minute about their own re-election and about what's going on in Iraq, they might come up with something. I don't know, I doubt it, but they might. But all they're thinking about is the timing of world events to help the re-election. Saddam's capture was too soon from that point of view, and it's forgotten and it's had nil impact. And Howard Dean, to his credit, who stood up and said the capture of Saddam is going to make no difference to the safety of our soldiers in the field, was vilified, if you remember. Well, he's been proved to be totally right. So I fear that they might organize a token pullout. They're trying to say that they will have in the summer a government in Iraq, which will be an Iraqi government. This will be the government they've already appointed. So you appoint a government, say we're handing over power to the people we've appointed, and we're now withdrawing. They won't withdraw their troops, but they will claim they no longer run the country politically. The British tried this every single time. Every single time. In Iraq, and it didn't work. It works for a short time and then it implodes. And that's exactly what will happen if they try and maintain the occupation by other means. And I fear that that's what they'll try and do. If Bush is defeated and you have a democratic government, the American empire will then put some clothes on. Hopefully they'll have the guts to withdraw, because it's happened in the past when there's been a change of regime. they've withdrawn. Eisenhower, it was, who pulled the troops out of Korea, etc. But we will see. It's very difficult. Yeah, it's very. I don't know whether there'll be a civil war. I hope not. It depends to a large extent on when the United States leaves, actually. The sooner the better to avoid that. But if things get so much that the way the country is run is in federal units, and you have these three units, the Shias in the south, the Sunni triangle, and the Kurds, it then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And historically, all empires have divided and ruled, or most of them, not all of them, but most Western empires have ruled only by making these divisions. But there's a big problem. If they Balkanize Iraq and try and create a Kurdish state, they annoy their Turkish allies, who will probably not take this lying down. So it's a messy situation for them.
A question was asked regarding the likelihood of weapons of mass destruction conveniently turning up right before the American elections.
Well, I don't think so, because the whole world has now seen this farce unfolding before its eyes. If they were going to plant them, they'd have planted them very early on. And there are enough people in Iraq now of different sorts who are reporting and sending out good reports. And it's very difficult to do that now. I mean, it's quite a large country. Very few things remain secret. But in terms of the first part of your question, I think they knew. They were pretty sure that there wasn't anything, because that's what the inspectors, including Scott Ritter, who's a Republican voter, had informed them earlier on, that there weren't any weapons of mass destruction. The problem for them was the following. They knew that to take Iraq the way they were going to was in violation of every single international law. I mean, the whole United Nations Charter was written to prevent preemptive strikes by states, because that's what the Germans and the Italians had done constantly during the 20s and 30s and 40s. And that's why the UN Charter, written after the war, prohibited preemptive strikes, except in the very rare cases of self-defense. So in order to show that they were defending themselves, they had to blow Saddam and the Iraqi regime out of all proportion to show they were threatened. But it didn't work, and no one believed it in the intelligence agencies. I mean, really, do read Susskind's book, the Paul O'Neill book, because in that, it's a sycophantic book, but it's very revealing. And in it, you see that at the very first meeting, there's an amazing scene at the National Security Council. George Tenet, the head of the CIA, comes in with a tiny, faded photograph taken from the sky of a factory in Iraq. And Cheney gets very excited, saying, that's it, that's the weapon, that's where they're doing them. And according to O'Neill, Cheney says to everyone lining the walls, the aides, come, watch this. This is very, very important. And O'Neill goes to see it, and he says, it's just a faded photograph. It can't tell anything. And they were trying to recreate the Cuban Missile Crisis, where they did have these aerial photographs, which did show missiles. But there were, it showed them because they were there. This time they showed these photographs of disused factories, and Tenet, said, well, look, it could be, but there's no evidence. Even he said, we don't know, it could be possible. So it's very obvious, both from what went on here and what went on in Britain, that they were desperately pushing the intelligence agencies to come out with this information in order to convince skeptical citizens of the need to go to war. It succeeded here, it failed in Britain.
What, someone asked, were the motivations of the various Bush administration officials pushing for war in Iraq, and was this affected by some of their connections with the Likud government in Israel?
Well, I think there was an element of that. I don't think it was the dominant element. I mean, neither Pearl nor Wolfowitz, nor Frum have made any secret of their pro-Israeli views. And we also know that Sharon and the Israeli leadership wanted this regime out of the way because they regarded it as the only regime with the potential to fight Israel. So that is true, but that has been true for 20 years. And so I don't think that was the dominant motive. The dominant motive, and there were lots of subsidiary ones which brought everyone together, was a display of imperial power and the neoliberalization of Iraq, the taking of its assets and massive privatizations. And this is a country which had one of the best health services and education systems in the Arab world. Large numbers of women were educated in Iraq under the Ba'athist regime prior in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, became doctors, social workers, teachers, integrated in society at every level. It had a functioning health system. Now, basically, what's going on is that it's being privatized. Big private companies who specialize in privatization in the United States and Britain are in Iraq privatizing the Iraqi health system. So I think the aim was to bring this country, which was out of line, into line with the Washington consensus, and at the same time to display what imperial power can do, not just for that region, but as a shot across the bows of the Far Eastern countries, the future rivals, which frighten the think tanks around the Pentagon more than anything else.
What positive steps can students with little money or power take?
Well, I think campaigns, long-term campaigns for divestment have been effective in the past. I think firm, strong questioning of establishment people when they come, keeping up a permanent presence against the war. That's why I think March the 20th is very important. These are things that can be done in the short term, but it varies from campus to campus, depending on the balance of forces. But certainly the divestment campaigns were very important in relation to South Africa. So I think these activities, they don't bring immediate results, but in the long run they can be very effective. And I think that the movements for global justice, which assemble every year at the World Social Forum, have to now take US militarism on as one of the targets. It's not just the corporations. The World Social Forum and the movements for global justice, in my view, have underestimated the power both of the United States and the importance of other states. And this has to be looked at again. So these are the things that you can do on the campuses without spending any of your own money.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. We're listening to author and social critic Tariq Ali, who spoke recently at Binghamton University. A member of the audience asked Ali to elaborate on previous statements he'd made concerning the Pakistani military and their support for the Taliban.
Well, the point I was making in that interview is very simple, which is that the victory of the Taliban in Afghanistan could not have been achieved without the Pakistan army. I mean, the Taliban didn't, drop from heaven. They were trained in special schools in Pakistan, trained by sections of the army, and then unleashed to defeat the Northern Alliance in Kabul. They themselves would not have been able to do that. So everyone knows that it was the support of the Pakistan army which got them to do that. And the Pakistan army then had to unravel this, the only victory in its entire history after 9/11, and they did so. The Taliban didn't fight, the bulk of them. So that's basically what took place, and I don't think that there